Good evening, and welcome to Coast AM. I'd like to welcome everybody listening all around the world, all across the United States. We are coming to you live from the nerve center of the known universe, that is the Coast Studios right here in Los Angeles, California. Sitting in for George tonight, it is I, Jimmy Church, who will guide you through until tomorrow morning. While George is traveling across the country for his event in Asheville, North Carolina, with Joshua P. Warren, Micah Hanks, and William Forston. Tickets are still available for that event, by the way. Just go to the Coast website and click on the event right there on the homepage. It is called George Norrie and Friends Living It Up in Asheville. And there's also going to be a really cool meet and greet after the show. So go check it out right now over at the Coast website. If you're in the area, I think you might even be able to walk up tomorrow. Also, tomorrow night, I'm going to be back here at Coast, and my guest will be Margot Mateus and Lori McDonald. It's going to be a great evening tomorrow night. But tonight, my guest is Randy Kramer, and his story is fantastical, and I get that. It's one that I think we just need to listen to, seriously. Because with me, and the way that I deal with things is, I listen, and I listen to all sides. I want to collect information. I want to know it all. I really do. It's not my job to be judge or jury and all of that stuff. It's my job to collect that information along with you. And Randy's story is just a small piece of that puzzle. And I'm sure that, you know, once that thing is complete, that puzzle is done, and we all look back at the different pieces and remember each one, we're going to remember Randy. So sit back, turn down the lights, because the studio here is dark as always, and we just need to match. It's just you and I going on a little late night journey. And don't forget, it's Friday. Later tonight after Randy Kramer, it's going to be open lines, you and I all night long. You can follow me right now on Twitter at J Church Radio. That's what you want to do, because I keep Twitter live to my left throughout the show. Any questions or comments, you can hit me up there in real time. Sitting in for George, it's me, Jimmy Church. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'll be right back with our guest, Captain Randy Kramer. Stay there. Our guest tonight is Captain Randy Kramer. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. But before we get to Randy, I just want to remind everybody, you need to become a Coast Insider. I'm a Coast Insider. A Coast Insider is a fan of all things curious and unexplained. You get an all-access pass to exclusive coast-to-coast content covering current events, conspiracy theories, paranormal phenomena, alien abduction, and much, much more. Become an insider today. You can sign up at coasttocoastam.com and browse the last 5 years of show archives, all for just 15 cents a day. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Our guest tonight, Captain Randy Kramer. And I'll be back with Randy right after this short break. Oh, we're going straight to Randy. Dan, our board op, says, Jimmy, just go to Randy. So I'm just going to go to Randy. Randy, good evening.
Good evening, Jimmy.
Sorry about that. I thought we were going to go to a commercial break, but we didn't. So good evening. And
good evening.
And Randy, I normally would do an introduction here at this spot, and I want to kind of do things a little bit differently tonight. This is what I want to do. There are people out there that that follow you, that know what you're about. Then you have the other half that doesn't, and maybe tonight is the first time that they have ever heard about you or your past, and they're now looking at your website and your bio, and they are going to say, wait a minute, let's slow down here for a second. He's a captain in the Marines, and he's been to Mars. How is that possible? And somebody with these kind of statements has got to have some kind of proof. So for that half of the audience, how would you respond to that?
Impersonating an officer is a felony. Lying about duty stations or defrauding the public is a felony. And if anybody gave a crap, well, I mean, certainly the Marine Corps would give a crap, and I've been doing this for almost 3 years, and I haven't heard a word from them. So that would be the first thing that I would say, is that if I were misrepresenting myself or lying in any way, shape, or form, I'd be doing quite a bit more of a disservice than just not telling the truth. I would be committing a number of felonies. So, and if that were true, I would imagine I would have gotten some letters or some knocks on my door or some phone calls or something, and no, I have not. I don't expect to. So, not to be rude to anybody, but unranked civilians with no security clearance don't really bother me or sway my opinion about anything one way or the other. If they think one way or the other about me, I don't really care. And so, as long as the people who really give a crap or that matter in my world are completely approving of what I do, then I don't really give a crap what anybody else thinks. But that is what I would say to that, is that if I were misrepresenting myself or lying, I would be committing a number of felonies.
Well, I'm going to do this. I want to start in the now, and then we're going to go backwards. So what I want to address directly is that you have been given authority to address the public on behalf of the command staff of the United States Marine Corps. And when did they approach you for this? And who was it that said, you know what, we need you to go ahead and start to bring this information to the public?
I guess that would have been about August of 2013. My brigadier general approached me and asked me if I wanted to consider going public, to which I was not really thrilled about the idea at first, I'll say that. And we kind of had some words about it, but he convinced me, really sort of laid it out for me. And let's just say, you know, there was some appeal as well. I was going to get a security clearance upgrade and regular briefings, et cetera, et cetera. So there was some reason for me to say yes, other than just, you know, in order to talk to people, which I'm, you know, in some ways I really could care less about whether I get to be the person to talk to people or not. I'm perfectly happy to do it, but there's like no motivation personally inside of me to like, oh yeah, I want to be that guy. Like, that's just not my motivation. So when I was asked to do it, I was like, really? You got to be kidding me. Really? You got to be kidding me. You got to have someone better who's not going to be as snarky and use as much potty mouth as I do. But apparently they were cool with that. So.
And did you ask them why you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and then my brigadier general made it pretty clear that there was a short list of officers that was about 20 long, and that they went down the list through sort of a selection process, and when it came down to the end, there was just me and or me and maybe a few other people that they decided to ask how they felt about it and then sort of go from there, and yeah, it just ended up being me. So it wasn't like there was no other person but me, and that was not how it was. There was a short list, and I was on that short list, and then through the selection process, I became the person who got selected. So, however all that works.
And have you disclosed his name?
I have said the name that he uses professionally, which is Brigadier General Julian Smythe, but I've also pointed out to people who have said to me, well, I've Googled him, and I can't find him, and really, why would you? Why would you find the names of military officers in unacknowledged special access programs on the internet? Because they don't exist there. That would be just the most ridiculous thing in the world. So, you know, people can feel free to want to try and look him up and not find anything about him, because there wouldn't be anything on the internet about him ever at all, because that's the way that program works. But yeah, I mean, I can, you know, he's given me his name. I've told that name before, but it doesn't necessarily mean to people outside the military industrial complex. So, but to those people, they know that, you know, I am speaking with the direct authority of my superiors when I say that, so.
And I know that you have said in the past, and you have said to me, and you referenced this a few minutes ago, that nobody has approached you from the DOD to cease and desist, stop representing yourself as, you know, as a Marine and as a captain. That hasn't happened. And why do you think that is? In other words, you've had your commanding officer say to move forward, but there could be other members of the military that don't want this to happen, but they haven't stepped forward and said anything. Why do you think that is?
Well, some of them have, and some I've gotten some harassment and some sort of, you know, language and emailing from certain people. The first, nationwide radio show that I ever did was Ground Zero Radio with Clyde Lewis out of Portland, Oregon. And immediately after I did the first show with him, they got an email from some guy who claimed to be with the ASA, which is the Army Security Agency, saying, oh, no, those are implanted memories. Really, he's a bullcrap. And, you know, they called me about that, and I was like, oh, wow, that was fast. I wasn't expecting someone to immediately, you know, like, try and say that. But the ASA is what I would call one of the, you know, smaller, you know, sort of testicularized organizations in the military intelligence complex. They're pretty small. They don't really mean much of anything. But they've certainly, several times, people have said, well, these ASA guys keep saying you're full of crap. And I'm like, well, who cares?
That's
the end of the Army. But
sure, yeah. And that's interesting. And they did it through Clyde. Did they ever reach out to you directly, or they just did it through Clyde?
Oh, they've sent several messages through Clyde and his producers to, you know, talk smack about me, but they've never talked to me directly. And, yeah, no, there's an absolute process for if I were committing fraud, you know, there's letters and phone calls and cease and desist and so forth. And, I'm sure I would have gotten those by now. But the other thing I would say about that is if they were said, hey, you're full of crap and we're going to take you to court, I would be like, sweet, I'm so excited about that, because then I could demand JAG representation with the proper security clearances, and I could say, great, I'd love a hearing. And that's really the last thing they want, right, is to go through that legal process, or to accelerate that legal process by attacking me with the proceedings. So even people who don't like me or who would be my enemy would not be served by attacking me through that legal venue. That this doesn't serve them one way or the other. So really the only thing anybody can do is say things behind the scenes or attack my computer or attacks computer systems for people when I'm doing interviews or erase files, which just happened. We had to redo an interview I just did with someone because they erased a file. The original first interview did with Michael Sala, they went in and deleted audio portions of that. And I mean, you know, but that's just been nonstop since the beginning.
Now let's go to your childhood. Let's go back to 4. And I know that there were events that went on before that, but how were you selected to move into this program at the age of 4?
I would say that really the selection process goes pre-being born. And I was, Project Moonshadow was a project in which all 300 test subjects were genetically engineered and built from the ground up. I call it the Petri dish stage. But obviously, we're talking about something a little more complicated scientifically than an actual, just a Petri dish. But when we say that there was a team of scientists assisted by extraterrestrial engineers who put a sequence together and used the raw genetic material of biological human parents plus whatever other augmented DNA and genetics they wanted to put in there, sequenced that all out and then patented those and, you know, got those people fully gestated into born fetuses and then into people which were already at that point registered Marines under Project Moonshadow. So I jokingly sometimes say that I was a Marine since I was a baby, but that is actually legally true.
Was there paperwork that was processed at that age through your parents? I mean, who was authorized to allow this program to go forward?
No. I mean, there was no ever authorization by my parents, but the authorization by the program itself was through a number of what would be considered at the time legal channels. And again, there's this quasi sort of legal area where, because I'm not exactly, oh, we're going to borrow your son. Here, can you sign the paperwork off? More like, hey, we're going to borrow some of your genetic material and make you a son, and then he's going to work for us. You don't mind, do you? Legally, you know, I realize there's some splitting hair distinctions there, but that is sort of the difference between how the project was set up. It wasn't really set up to be, hey, we're just going to take your kid, so much as, hey, we're going to build you a kid and then use him. You don't mind. So it was, yeah, a little different.
And what's interesting here is this was the beginning of a 20-year commitment. It would involve the moon, the Mars, defending the Earth, and defending Mars. Pretty complicated program. Was all of this laid out for you, and you knew what you were being trained for and what the objectives were for the next 20 years?
Well, the 20-year tour started at age 17. The training period before that is, you know, 13 or 14 or so years or whatever. And then the actual tour of duty is 20 or so years. It really sort of ends up being a little bit more than that. But I would say vaguely, the answer to that question, vaguely I knew what I was supposed to do, but there was no sense early on in the training program that what I was already predestined to go to Mars and serve in the MDF. That, there was no notion of that. There was just the notion that you're working in a covert military project with advanced technology, being trained to fight things that other people are, you know, would pee their pants if they had to face in the field. So you know that much. But beyond that, you don't know much specifically where you're going to go or what you're going to do until it's time to go there.
And as in with, let's say, the Navy or the Air Force, where you're looking at different aircraft and ships that enemy forces would use, in your training, did you have different aliens that were presented with you and different craft and alien technologies? Was it that kind of education and training?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the full training, education and training program is what I would say your standard military training, with everything stacked on top of that, that it would involve any more advanced technology that we also have that isn't used by the regular military that would be included in that, as well as any potential knowledge or information about technology used by allies or potential threats that you also might need to know in the field. So yeah, it's quite a library of information that, you know, you get to go over.
Was Moonshadow only limited to those 300, or did it expand and does it continue to this day?
No, that particular program was a limited program, and other programs which may have been modeled after similar ways of doing things certainly could have existed post that, but the individual program itself was a 300 test subject program that began and ended with those 300 test subjects.
Did those 300 of your classmates, if you will, did all of them end up deployed in Radiant Garden and Solar Warden?
I wouldn't have any information about that.
And, okay, now we're going to be headed towards a break, and I want to clarify a couple of things for the audience, and that is what Radiant Garden and Solar Warden are and the differences with that and Moonshadow. Exactly what is Radiant Garden and Solar Warden?
Sure. The fleet overall, which is the Earth Defense Force fleet, which can be... A lot of people refer to it by a number of different names, but essentially in the same way that you have an Atlantic fleet and a Pacific fleet, you have the solar system and an imaginary line that divides down the middle and separates into two sides, which then divides into two fleets, which are Solar Warden and Radiant Guardian.
Got you. And now, also for clarification, because we're going to be discussing this for the rest of the night, we're talking about a 20-year tour, 17 of which... dealt with Mars. What were the other 3 years?
That was serving as a pilot on the EDF SS Nautilus in an air wing.
And the EDF Nautilus was?
It's essentially a flying aircraft carrier for outer space. We call them, it's classified as what is an IG Highliner, and the IG stands for intergalactic, which just means that it has the ability to travel intergalactically. And the class is called a Highliner. It essentially looks like a long tube that's half a mile or so long, and can carry, depending on the actual outfitting, you know, 8 to 10 air wings of fighter bomber craft. There's an engineering section, the middle section, which is the air wing section, and then the forward command section. They're pretty big.
And how many personnel are on that? And really quick, if you will, what was the aircraft or spacecraft that was used between Earth, the Moon, and Mars?
I couldn't tell you the exact number of personnel, because engineering personnel wouldn't be something that we would have known the number of, and command personnel would also not be something we knew a number of. Everything was pretty compartmentalized.
Right.
So, but I would still say that you're probably asking the question, what is the main vehicle that is still used to shuttle people and things back and forth? It's still the TR-3B.
TR-3B?
And still the workhorse. The Black Manta is still the workhorse.
Which is the black triangle that has been seen and sighted. Yeah, there you go. Our guest tonight is Captain Randy Kramer. He's an officer who has been given authority to address the public on behalf of the Space Command staff of the United States Marine Corps Special Section that was created by President Eisenhower in 1953. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. I'll be right back. More with Randy Kramer right after this. You can catch George Norrie's internet TV show, Beyond Belief. It's for dynamic discussions of the paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained. You can check out previews right now over at beyondbelief.com. You can sign up for just 99 cents for the first month and enjoy hours of fascinating past shows. Just go to beyondbelief.com. Our guest tonight, Captain Randy Kramer. He spent 20 years off-world duty, 17 of which was serving with the Mars Defense Force. He finished his service aboard the EDF SS Nautilus as a pilot under Project Radiant Guardian. He is our guest. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, and we'll be back with more with Randy right after this short break. Welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Sitting in for George tonight, he is over in Asheville, North Carolina at his event. And more on that in the next break. Captain Randy Kramer worked in a covert military intelligence branch with specific authority over extraterrestrial, multidimensional, non-human, and off-world beings, consortiums, and collectives, either sanctioned or unsanctioned, within actionable reach of any and all global territory. He is the project of Soldier Augmentation Project Moonshadow, a training program for children which began with him at the age of 4. Yes, he later spent a 20-year tour of duty off-world, over 17 of which was serving on the Mars Defense Force. He finished his service aboard the EDF SS Nautilus as a pilot under Project Radiant Guardian. In August 2013, his superior officers requested that he consider going public with their blessing, and he began to share his personal experiences with the world, and he started that in April of 2014. Now, Randy, take me through your high school years leading up to your high school graduation. What was that like? Because immediately after that, you went straight into the Marine Corps. Did any of your classmates, did you discuss this with your teachers, your friends, your parents? And did you know what was going to happen immediately after graduation?
It's important to understand that there are kind of two realities going on here at the same time, which is the one in which I interact with everybody in a normal way and the one in which I don't interact with everyone in a normal way, because I learned at a pretty early age. I might wake up from an evening of sort of medication, drugging, training activities, you know, different kinds of things going on in my brain, and say, oh, I had the weirdest dream last night, and get concerned looks from people. And you start to realize when you get concerned looks that maybe you shouldn't talk about that. So there were certain things that, whether I knew fully consciously what was happening or not, I just didn't talk about it to anybody. So the parts that I fully understood, I didn't talk to anybody. The questionable parts, I certainly didn't talk to anybody about. So there was the, you know, in many ways, living a double life, like a spook of here's how everybody interacts with me on a daily basis and how they know me versus the person who I am inside my body and my head that I know that I am based on this other training and things that I'm being told about where I'm going and what I'm doing. So there's sort of two worlds colliding at that point in some ways, and nobody really had a clue what was going on, to be honest with you.
So after you graduated, what happened next, and how did they come and get you?
Well, it was actually before graduation, November, I want to say, because it's 2:30 in the morning, that makes it like November 18th, 1987. So I'm still 17 years old at the time, actually. And as per pretty normal procedure, they, you know, jump gate technicians come into the room through a jump gate and, you know, escort you out and go, you sort of know you're going off to another training session, except this was not a training session, which I kind of got the feeling for when, you know, I got handed the packet, you know, and they hand you like this big packet that's got your contract and everything and all your paperwork that you're going to need. You know, when someone handed me the packet, I kind of got the impression that this was not just a training session, but it was, you know, go away for, you know, take essentially go to a way station where you get on a TR-3B. It was in like a 90-minute flight to the moon to LOC, Luna Operations Command, which is, then there's another process, which is less than 48 hours, which is a medical exam, going over your contract, signing and initialing your contract in 20,000 different places, and then waiting in between that, and then getting on a transport ship, and then that's more like a 15, 20-minute flight before you get to Mars. That was that flight. And then, you know, a 20-year tour of duty. And then the fun part is because they managed to arrange all of this stuff through Time Corps and can sort of take you back 5 minutes after you left. And they say they go through an age-reversing process. It's not really age-reversing so much as they hatch out a fresh clone, pump your soul out of your body, which is a quantum fluid. I just want to point that out. It's a quantum fluid, and therefore you can pump it out and pump it back into a temporary object or another body. So they pump your soul out of your body and then put you into a fresh clone that they've hatched out in 48 or 72 hours or something like that. So 15 minutes after I left at 2:45 a.m. on November the 18th, 1987, I was put back in my bed and, you know, put back to sleep and woke up the next morning, looked in the mirror and went, wow, that was the longest, weirdest dream I've ever had. But looking in my face in my mirror saying, oh, nothing. Well, what happened? And then going through, you know, essentially a 20-year recovery process to sort of deal with that. So that's the short version of how that went.
How, explain to me this quantum fluid extraction. Are you saying that all of your consciousness, all of your memories, your personality, everything is extracted and is contained in this fluid, and it is merely transferred into another body that is a clone of yours? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, it's not really my area to say that I understand soul science well enough to try and describe how this works, other than to say everyone at their most fundamental is a quantum fluid. And that quantum fluid is made up of very, 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 very tiny particles that form a fabric and essentially is the most core essence of what you are in this lifetime, in this incarnation, as you exist in this universe. And that because you're in a quantum fluid, it's the thing that allows you to interact in this universe with time, with flowing time, that sort of ticks, you know, 1 second at a time, because when you're not incarnated in a reality or in a universe, you exist in a timeless energetic state. And so in order to experience time or growth or existence, you have to sort of go through this experience, this energetic transformation through the void and through into this quantum fluid. And then that's sort of how you embody your soul, to my understanding of that. Now, again, I don't really understand how it's done, other than that it is a quantum fluid. Quantum fluids can be pumped in and out and stored in other objects and containers. So yeah, that means they can take your soul out of your body, put it into a temporary container, or put it into another person or into another clone or into an extraterrestrial body, take an extraterrestrial soul, pump it out of their body, put it into your body or into another temporary container, back and forth, etc. So as weird and crazy and sci-fi as that may sound to some people, it's a technology, it's a science. We've cracked it some time ago, and we've been using it for a while.
How does that work on your DD-214? Or how does it work on your tax returns? I mean, if you know what I mean, does everybody, each iteration of yourself, do you have a new social security number? How many of you, you know, it sounds to me getting really complicated.
I suppose it could. I mean, there's still just one me, you know. So on paper, it doesn't matter how many bodies you sort of transfer me to. Like, on paper, I'm still one person. Contractually, I'm still one person. Legally, I'm still one person. I'm not sure exactly the subtleties of law on how they sort that out, but legally, that I'm still one person. And clones don't have the same rights as a person with a soul. I don't exactly understand how they break that down either, but there's always some contention and argument as well there about clone rights.
Well, how many versions removed from your original self are you?
Oh, that's a good question. That's hard to say. You know, life on Mars was rough. So, you know, I probably had my body blown apart, ripped apart, and shredded and rebuilt and, you know, replaced several dozens of times. So we're probably talking about, you know, having had my original chassis and body replaced, yeah, at least several dozen times.
And before we get to Mars and what is going on there, let's talk about the moon and the base that is there, that LOB. Did we have to battle for control of the moon before we built that base there? And how long has the base been there? I understand it's on the dark side. It's on the back side of the moon.
Correct. My understanding is we didn't have to fight for it at all. We basically just had to land and, you know, plant a flag and say, hey, we want to build here. And everyone was like, okay, fine. Just, you know, don't step on anybody else's sort of territory. The DMZ on the dark side of the moon, which has a lot of bases that belong to a lot of different ET species, which have been there for a very, very, very long time. And so, you know, essentially everyone's okay with everyone being there as long as everyone respects the DMZ. So we didn't have to fight for anything on the moon, as far as I understand. And we probably, you know, cracked the ground on that one between 1947 and 1950, to be honest with you, and probably had the first temporary military base on the moon in 1952 or 53, and probably had the first permanent station ground cracking being built, and what I would say probably the first landing station, or what would become the first spaceport, was probably started construction there in 1953, 1954.
What does it look like in the interior? Is there different stages? Is there a new wing, an older wing, and then like the really, really old part of the base? Tell me about that, and how are you determining these years? Is it because of the way it looks?
Absolutely. And that was one of the more surprising things that I found when I got there. So I'm, you know, the TR-3B that landed in comes into a pretty big docking bay, which, you know, at first you think you're just going into sort of a small landing pad, but then you realize you're in a very, very, very large landing bay with lots of slots, like rows up and down on a shelf where these ships can come in and land. And the ship comes in and lands, and everyone starts to disembark. And I certainly was expecting to see a lot of really super modern equipment and just everything super shiny and chromed out. I don't know, you know, watch too much TV. And, you know, one of the first things, there's this giant airlock that clearly the, you know, metal, you know, was molded, construction built, the hinges and so forth are all, you know, metal parts that were constructed sometime in the 1940s or maybe in the early 50s. And, you know, believe me, you know, if you've seen enough, you know, metal construction parts, enough engines, enough door handles, you know, over the 20th century, you know, there's a real distinction between, you know, engineering and metal pressing and so forth. And so, you know, I'm expecting this some really advanced space door, and it's this airlock that was, you know, obviously molded out and printed, pressed in the 50s or something. The administration section where we went to sign contracts had, you know, worn carpet and wallpaper and furniture that was circa 1973 or 5, because it was exactly the same kind of, you know, furniture and carpet that, you know, was in just about every doctor dentist office that I had been at that time in that era. And anybody else who's ever been in a doctor dentist office in the 70s knows what I'm talking about. the part of the medical section, two different medical sections that I've been to, one which was very, very, very modern and very, very Star Trek-y, and another one that, you know, looked like from, again, signage, doors, windows, carpentry, cabinetry, and so forth. You know, you feel like you've practically walked into a movie set from a World War II movie because everything, you know, the hospital looks like, with the exception of the personnel, how they're dressed, and some of the equipment, everything around you looks like you're practically walking into a you know, Bing Crosby movie or something, because it's just, everything looks so old.
Well, how do you know, Randy, how do you know that it wasn't a movie set?
Because it was really big. It was really way too vast to be a movie set. And the hangar bay, which the shuttle that actually the transport ship that took us off of the moon, that place was huge. That place had a scale to it that was so large, I couldn't tell you how big it was stem to stern. I mean, it was that big. There's no way that I could tell you whether it was 400, 500, 600 yards wide, whether the hangar was a half a mile wide, you know, 500 feet high, 8 stories high. I couldn't really tell you. It was just way too vast. There's no way that that could have been a movie set anywhere that I've ever seen on planet Earth.
You know, I've often asked this question from other guests that I've had with similar experiences as yours, and it's an honest question, which is this. How do you not know or determine that you may have been part of some sinister mind control experiment, you know, some MK Ultra victim, and all of these memories, although they're real to you, were implanted, and you are being used as a crazy disinfo tool?
That's a fair question. All I can say is that many, many, many years ago, as I started to recover full memory, the process for which I went through that personal meditative process to regain every single ounce and inch and frame of memory that I could was a lengthy process which adds up to more than, you know, thousands of hours of knowing how my, getting to know how my mind works. And anyone who has taken enough time to get to know how their mind works can start to understand the differences between the ways in which your mind communicates to you and the frames, the textures, the colors. There are a number of different sort of, and this is all distinctive to any individual as you go through this process, but any individual who's done it for enough time starts to get a real distinct, a clear understanding of the difference between a dream, a vision, a hallucination, or a memory. And as you get better and better at recalling memory, they get sharper and sharper and more vivid. And so I think if you're really trying to get at clear memory and you start to go through false memories, those don't get more clear. They get fuzzier and then they start to disintegrate because false memories aren't real. So the harder you look at a false memory, the more fuzzy it will actually get. The more you look at a real memory, the more clear, sharp, and focused and precise it will get. So I can say with a high degree of confidence, having had a very dear friend of mine who was a psychiatrist who I sat down with and said, maybe I'm crazy. And he said, well, let's bust out the DSM-4 and find out. And, you know, we determined that I'm not crazy and that I had a scorching case of post-traumatic stress disorder, which I felt I needed to, you know, sort through. But, you know, I feel through thousands and thousands of hours of a personal process as well as a process working through with other people, mental health professionals, therapists, doctors, other people to help me understand whether in fact I was actually having a true and real experience or losing my freaking mind. And I can say after a 20-year healing process, more than 5,000 hours of working on it and talking to a number of professionals, I feel really confident that we're talking about solid and real memories and not fake or screen memories or anything like that.
Our guest tonight is Captain Randy Kramer. He did spend 20 years with the Mars Defense Force. 3 years were as a pilot of the EDF SS Nautilus. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. More with Randy right after this break. Stay with us.